Hello, and welcome to the Dietitian Cafe, brought to you by Nualtra, the innovative medical nutrition company dedicated to improving patients' lives through specialised and affordable supplements. My name is Corinne Toyne, and I'm a registered dietitian and marketing specialist at HRS Communications. We invite you to drop into the Dietitian Cafe as we discuss the latest nutrition trends, topics, and research. Every month, two episodes are released. One is an interview with a featured guest and the other a debate highlighting a hot topic in the world of nutrition and dietetics. However, before I start, can I ask you a huge favour? If you enjoy the Dietitian Cafe podcast, we'd be super grateful if you could press that follow button. More subscribers means more exciting guests and more interesting conversations for you, our listeners. Thank you. For our debate today, we will be discussing the hot topic of nutrition misinformation. In recent months, it has been the subject of much debate amongst nutrition experts, and we've seen posts across social media and discussing it with our peers around the spread of misinformation, the damage it does, and brainstorming the best ways to deal with it. So in this month's episode, we're tackling it head on and bringing together experts who know their stuff to unpack nutrition misinformation and share their top tips on combating it. I'm delighted to be joined by Anna Wheeler, a registered nutritionist with 20 years of experience in a range of nutrition roles, along with Lauren Griffin, a registered dietitian with experience across both the NHS and private sectors. So without further ado, welcome to the Dietitian Cafe, Lauren and Anna. It's great to have you both with us. I'll hand over to you to introduce yourself a little further. Anna, let's come to you first.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me. As it, I think we have got a really interesting topic, so can't wait to dive in. So, like you mentioned, I'm a registered nutritionist. I have somehow reached that milestone of being in the business for 20 years now. I don't know quite how that's happened. So looking back, I started my career at a trade association, and then I spent about 11 years in total in various different roles at Unilever and then Coca-Cola Great Britain. So I was doing various things at those two companies. I did local and global roles, communications and stakeholder engagement, both of which I think will be very relevant today. And then also roles within catering and technical, for example. So quite varied within those organizations. I then decided to go freelance and I started my own consultancy business in 2017. Then a year later, in 2018, I co-founded a company called Nutrition Talent, and that's where I spend most of my time now. So really, we do three things at Nutrition Talent. We do nutrition consultancy, that's either in-house or working with our database of over 1,000 nutrition professionals. Or we do recruitment, which is usually of nutrition-focused roles, but sometimes that stretches to wider roles within nutrition companies, which again, I think might be quite relevant to the discussion today. And that's at all levels, right from graduate to the most senior of roles. And then we do career development. So we offer free career conversations to our community every month. We run career workshops, and we also have our own podcast, The Humans of Nutrition. But this is actually the first time I have ever been on anyone else's podcast. So it's a new experience being the other side of the microphone, as it were. So really looking forward to it. So thanks again for having me.
Great to have you. And yeah, your podcast is also a fantastic resource for nutrition professionals. I recommend anyone to go and check that out. How about you, Lauren?
Thanks, Corinne. I'm so excited to be discussing this topic with both of you today. I feel like it's going to be a very interesting discussion. So, I'm Lauren. I'm a HCPC registered dietitian working in the NHS and private sector. I have extensive clinical experience in oncology, surgery and ITU, among other specialities. And I'm very committed to continued professional development, completing my PENG clinical update in 2021, as well as presenting research projects at international conferences such as EFAD. Alongside my clinical work, I run my own freelance consultancy, providing one-to-one nutritional coaching and health writing. So translating the complex science of nutrition into practical strategies for everyday life, which I think will be very useful as we come on to discuss nutritional misinformation. I'm extremely passionate about dispelling nutritional misinformation, and my most recent focus has been on things like ultra-processed foods and continuous glucose monitoring, which showcases my commitment for accurate information in the space and highlights my advocacy for nutritional literacy.
Wonderful. They are very topical issues, shall we say, or you know, points of discussion at the moment. So yeah, you're clearly got your finger on the pulse in terms of making sure that those areas are covered and we're protecting the general public, which is what we're going to be talking about today. So as we always do, let's kick off the podcast with a couple of questions to get to know you both a little better. Let's go to you first, Anna. The first question is, which TV show would you like to feature in and why?
Now, I absolutely love this question, and I'm assuming that means we are allowed to go into total dream world here. So the TV show I would like to be on isn't necessarily a traditional TV show, but as a massive tennis fan, both watching and playing, what I would absolutely love is to feature in the coverage of Wimbledon on the BBC. So I think I may have missed my chance unless they bring in some sort of category for over 40s average club players, but that's what I would really like to feature in.
Never say never. I think tennis is one of the coolest sports out there. I would love to be able to play tennis. I'm just so bad at it. I've tried it time and time again. So yeah.
Keep trying.
Yeah, very cool. How about you, Lauren?
I feel like I can't beat Anna's. That's such a good one. Mine is Race Across the World. I just think it would be a fantastic TV show to be a part of. I'm quite competitive. I love travel. I feel like the weird and wonderful routes they do would just be a really exciting way to kind of get across the country. So that would probably be my number one TV show that I'd like to go on.
Amazing. Both very outside the box answers there. I would have gone for MasterChef for myself, which is a bit more.
Did you do that? Gosh,
I love cooking. I'd be like one of the novice MasterChef type of people, like not, you know, the real deal. But yeah, I just love cooking shows. It's like my happy space. But anyway, second question is, what's bringing you joy at the moment, Anna?
Well, what is really bringing me joy at the moment is the changing of the seasons, and particularly the start of the growing season. So I never thought I'd become a gardener, but when I moved into my current house, which has quite a big garden, including a veggie patch, I got very into it. So my biggest joy at the moment is my little tomato seedlings have started to pop up just over the last couple of days. My asparagus is also starting to emerge and rhubarb starting to grow. So things are happening, and yeah, soon the veggie patch will be in full force.
Absolutely love that. Simple pleasures. That's where it's at. Love that. What about you, Lauren?
Mine's very similar. I'm getting so much joy from the days getting lighter and seeing those first kind of glimmers of summer coming through and being able to get outside more and go for nice walks. Now it's a lot lighter and just enjoying this season's changing.
Really nice. Spring is my favourite time of year. It's just so lovely. So much excitement and promise for the year ahead. Couldn't agree more there. So let's move on to the episode questions. Recently, the spread of nutrition misinformation has been rife. Let's start today's discussion with the basics. What are the main sources of nutrition misinformation at the moment, Lauren?
I would definitely say social media is probably the main source. Things like platforms such as TikTok, Instagram, as well as podcasts, I think they're contributing so much to this kind of spin of nutritional misinformation.
I am inundated with podcasts, videos, audio snippets, basically so much content with, you know, clickbaity style headlines that are designed to draw you in and make you stop scrolling. And often these belong to high profile people online, including celebrities and social media influencers. Anna, what role do they play in spreading nutrition misinformation, especially as many of them aren't qualified nutrition professionals?
Yeah, well, obviously they play a very big role. And I think really we should probably start with the positive, that there are some influencers out there that are doing a good job, despite not necessarily having nutrition qualifications and are potentially aware of their limitations. But saying that, there are also obviously a lot of people who aren't doing so well and don't share that ambition that we all would share as nutrition professionals to put across that evidence-based information. But I guess, you know, obviously you just mentioned that clickbait. And I think that's potentially one of the issues, is that probably because these people don't have those same qualifications and that knowledge, you know, they can make things sound more interesting than we can. You know, they're not bound by the same codes of conduct, the same regulatory constraints that we are, which potentially I think we'll talk about later. So they can make these things sound very interesting. You know, the awful sort of headlines like 5 ways to lose belly, you know, to lose your belly fat in, I don't know, a couple of weeks or something like that, that obviously we would never say as just one example. But you mentioned TikTok, Lauren, and I'm only now just really understanding quite the influence that is now having in the health space. And obviously social media is a changing beast. It's relatively new still to all of us. You know, with Twitter changing to X, that's completely changed that space. LinkedIn is becoming such a valuable community for professionals to share really good information, I think. But yeah, the TikToks, Instagrams, Facebooks, not to forget the traditional media, you know, the newspapers and magazines, which also aren't as highly regulated as some of the other areas of communication. You know, all of that is obviously part of the problem.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm also hearing, you know, I heard a fascinating stat at a conference the other day that 67% of Americans trust the information that they find on social media, which I find unbelievable and slightly terrifying. But they also actually said that they admit to seeing contradictions. So that makes me wonder why they trust it. But really, there's, you know, it's not a surprise that the public is completely confused.
Definitely. I mean, it does seem to be one big contradiction at the moment. That's such an interesting word that you use there as well, because I think it contributes to this confusion and mistrust. So even if some healthcare professionals are using evidence-based practice, you know, there's also disagreement even within the nutrition community. So I feel like the trust that the general public have in, you know, the health professional community as a whole is waning because of this situation, which just doesn't really help our cause. So yeah, it's a really difficult space. And Lauren, you kind of pointed out to podcasts there, which I think during COVID, many of us found them amazing sources of inspiration and enjoyment. And I'm a big podcast fan, but they have seemed to have taken a bit of a dark turn lately. And I'd love to hear your opinion on how podcasts contribute to the development of nutrition misinformation.
It's so funny you touched on COVID there, because I think since COVID, the public, everyone in general, is so much more interested in science and things like health. Obviously, health is a very emotive topic and there is a lot of mistrust. But also, like we've been saying, where we get our information from is changing, whereas traditionally it was from newspapers, media, different media sources than we're seeing today. And we are seeing a lot more podcasts with a lot of what I would call celebrity content creators, and I think they are very good at building communities, whether it be a health focused podcast or not. So they've already kind of gained listeners' trust, so they might then have big trending guests on that are spreading nutritional information. Or sometimes they actually start off by saying some really factual stuff about nutrition and science and health, but then what they do is they're kind of, they're real people in with that trust, and then they've kind of manipulated the final statements or the kind of big kind of punchline at the end to create those clickbait headlines, to create those kind of trending hot topics, to kind of make as much noise as possible to stay relevant. And I do think the public want simple answers to very complicated questions. So those that give oversimplified but compelling narratives soar to popularity quite quickly. And we are seeing that on a lot of podcasts. Influencers are placed in those positions of authority. They might go on a podcast, they might say, this is what I eat in a day. They're often lacking the relevant qualifications, but because they've gained people's trust or they're saying it on a podcast, a lot of podcasts have really big platforms. Of course you're going to trust a podcast if it's got, you know, 7 million subscribers. You're going to think, I can trust that source. So I think a lot of it is where the public place their trust and places that kind of gain authority without the relevant qualifications. And I think podcasts are listened to so widely, like you just said, Corinne, like during COVID, I was listening to so many hours of podcasts because it was passing the time. And if you're constantly being fed that information, you're not going to have reason to question it, or you are going to believe it because it's your favorite influencer saying it.
Yeah, definitely. And as you were talking there, there's two things that came to my mind. I think the first is that a podcast, the nature of a podcast is very welcoming, warm. You feel like you're listening to your friend. And I don't know about you, if my friend tells me to go and try something or recommend something, I'm way more likely to try it. I mean, there's something in word of mouth, you know, recommendation that is so powerful. And there's, I think that the podcast setting feels authentic and trusting. So I think that can be then quite a dangerous space if you're saying things that can be influential on someone's health. So there's that. And then I also think, you know, there's only so many times that you can say, eat a balanced diet, eat a Mediterranean diet. You know, you can't say that message time and time again and expect to kind of have people interested by that. Very powerful and very evidence-based message, but maybe not the most exciting. So that, you know, it becomes this issue of people trying to reinvent the wheel and making things more complicated than they need to be. So
Absolutely. I really feel like the advice that regulated nutritional professionals give isn't as always sexy as these massive clickbait headlines. And like you said, word of mouth. If my friend says, oh, try this, I might go and try that new lip gloss or that new product or all these different things. And I think it would be naive of us to think that that doesn't happen in nutrition.
Yeah, definitely. So, Anna, you mentioned newspapers and the traditional setting of, you know, clickbaity headlines on newspapers and magazines, and we've all seen it before. Do you think that nutrition misinformation has always been an issue?
I think there probably could be quite an easy answer to that, but maybe I'll go a bit further than just saying, yes, I think probably that it has been. And interestingly, I was at the nutritionist and industry meeting last week that I helped to organise, actually, and we celebrated the organisation's 30th anniversary, and we had some real nutrition pioneers back to celebrate that anniversary. And we had a panel discussion, and it was Judy Buttress, who's former Director General of the British Nutrition Foundation, who was actually advising us as, you know, current nutritionists and dietitians, of course, you know, how we could learn from the past. So, and actually use that phrase that you just used, that we don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel. So I think misinformation has definitely been an issue for a long time, but it does go in phases and trends, much like anything else, like fashion, obviously. And over time, it might have been additives, or, you know, everybody being scared of fat or sugar, salt, obviously now ultra processed foods, which I'm sure we'll probably talk more about later. You know, there's always something that's the real demon. And obviously, as you just said, you know, we're trying to get across a very balanced diet sort of message in a sexy way, which is very, very difficult. But obviously, we do need to move away from this demonizing of one food or nutrient. But I think really that's what these influencers do tend to do, whether it's demonizing or promoting. You know, it can obviously work either way. And yeah, obviously, I think this misinformation has been a problem for quite some time. And obviously, what we really probably should be doing is really getting back to basics. If we taught people how to cook, what nutrition was all about, even budgeting, for example, at a very early age from school, they wouldn't be as pulled in by this sensationalist, you know, advice that they are hearing from all of these other angles now.
Yeah. Well, firstly, congratulations on the 30-year anniversary of NII.
No, thank
it's
you.
A huge
thank
milestone. So yeah, that's wonderful. And secondly, going back then to our discussion around the spread of nutrition and misinformation, and whether it's always been an issue, do you think it's been on the rise? Do you think it's getting worse and worse? And if so, why?
I think it probably is getting a bit worse. But as I said, it has been pretty awful in the 20 years that I have been working in nutrition. But as we've already been talking about, that focus of attention is different now with that rise of social media and the fact that both good and bad news spread so quickly now. And I actually heard a stat recently that false information travels 6 times as fast as accurate information. And actually, you can kind of see how that might be true, because it is going to be terrifying or motivating in whatever way. And it is likely to be shared a lot more than that, you know, potentially boring health message that we might be trying to share. And obviously, we all know about Dr. Google that we all use now for other health advice, any health advice. And I think even us as, you know, professionals with a science background can sometimes find it hard to know where the best places to look are for particular pieces of information. So again, it's really not that surprising that the public is confused. And I think you add that into all of the potential other problems that everybody is facing at the moment, you know, the cost of living crisis, people being overworked, stressed, tired. And actually, we're trying to say to them, you know, avoid all ultra processed foods and cook everything from scratch. You know, not that we're saying that, but you know, some people are saying that. And people are potentially then going to go for the easy option. You know, if some influencer is going to say to them, actually, don't worry about all that complicated, difficult stuff. Just do this. All your problems will be solved.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Lauren, what about the intent behind the sharing of this content then? Do you think it's malicious?
I don't think it's necessarily malicious, or I hope it's not. And that could be me being really naive. I think it's more they don't realise the harm that they could cause because there's that lack of education. I do, however, think there are a lot of hidden agendas. The majority of people know what they're doing by using these clickbait headlines. They know that they're going to drive more people to that podcast, to that site, to that product even, and get more sponsors and essentially generate more profit and fame, which I really do believe things like the money is such a big hidden agenda at the moment. And it's really getting in the way of sharing credible advice.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Anna, can the food industry ever contribute to or benefit from perpetuating nutrition misinformation?
Wow, that's a very big question. And I think it brings up a lot of different things to talk about. I mean, first of all, the food industry is such a broad term. You know, that's obviously retailers, manufacturers, but also pretty much every eating establishment out there, from fine dining to your local fast food restaurant. But actually, most of the big companies do have nutrition expertise in-house. And it's really important to remember that what we can and can't say about food is already very, very highly regulated, both in terms of things like the product packaging, any claims that are made, and all communications that go alongside those. So obviously, right down to terms like low fat, contains vitamin C, what that vitamin C does to your body, even down to the wording that you can use to explain what vitamin C does to your body, you can't really veer away from that at all. There are various conditions of use that you have to incorporate for any claim that you want to make. So all this is laid down in food law. And so actually, it'd be quite difficult for the food industry to contribute to this misinformation without being pulled up on it by the relevant authorities. Of course, that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen from time to time. And I think it probably happens more with smaller organisations, be that your smaller food company who wouldn't have that nutrition expertise in-house, or a local cafe. And actually, I had just an example of this the other day when I was out for brunch and saw a sign for a beetroot latte, which they claimed would increase my energy, improve my immunity, and boost my stamina. So there's three illegal health claims right there. And obviously you would never see that on a product in Tesco or Sainsbury's or Marks and Spencer's, because obviously all of that due diligence will have gone on behind the scenes for the companies that get into those big stores. So I think that is partly due to the fact that the bigger organisations do employ nutrition professionals. I think it also goes back to, you know, one of the reasons that we set up Nutrition Talent is that, you know, we want to get the right professionals in the right places with the right credentials across all sectors, including some of the more emerging sectors, if you like, you know, into AI, which my fellow co-founder Danielle McCarthy works in at the moment, into, I don't know, fitness, you know, all of these different areas. Obviously, some of the more traditional routes like government and public health, you know, having those right people with the right credentials in place, you know, really helps to stop some of that misinformation. But then I think, obviously, if I think back to my experience working directly within the food industry, you work very, very closely with your marketing colleagues to ensure what goes out is accurate, is scientifically based, isn't misleading to the public. You know, that's always number one. And obviously there's a bit of tension there at times, but it is the job of us credentialed nutritionists and dietitians to really work very hard with them to find that engaging message that's going to suit the marketeers, but is also going to be credible and accurate.
I don't know. I think you've made a really good point. I think there is a lot of clash when it comes to the marketing, because obviously there is the regulations in place about what products can and can't say. But I think what I've seen at the moment, I would go as far as to say the nutrition industry is benefiting from misinformation purely because if you look at certain products, before they might have just had, the standard label, whereas now I'm seeing a lot more. So it might still be true. It might be high in protein. It might be low in fat. It might be not an ultra processed food. But before, they would never have put those claims on the packaging. Whereas now we are seeing really big brands or even kind of independent supermarkets own products slap a label on the front of something. It takes up so much of the product and it might say something like low in sugar, whereas that product is actually naturally low in sugar. And yes, it does meet the regulations. I think we'll come on to those a little bit later, but I think they are benefiting from it because they are marketing it in a way. So it might not be the food industry itself, but definitely from a marketing point of view, they are capitalizing on this misinformation.
Yeah, good point. I mean, as someone that works in marketing myself, I'm a big advocate of getting people, getting nutritionists and dietitians in marketing roles, because I think the ability to communicate the science is a skill that is unique to nutrition professionals. So, I think the science and the evidence is always changing, but the skill is being able to communicate it and translate that to what's important for consumers and healthcare professionals. And I think you've got to be a certain type of person to do that. So the more that we can, open up opportunities, and what you're doing at Nutrition Talent is amazing, Anna, because you are giving more opportunities and visibility, not even for nutritionists to apply, but and dietitians, but also for the industry to open up roles for nutritionists and dietitians to actually be aware that we have the skill set to be in these roles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think our professional bodies are doing a good job as well. And again, that might be something we want to talk about more, but obviously they are trying to raise the profile of registered nutritionists and registered dietitians as the people to go to for nutrition advice. And the more we can do that, the more we can get our credentials understood by the public, I think the better. So that's another key area I think we all need to work on. And I think, like you say, Corinne, it's such a key skill. And you mentioned it at the beginning, Lauren, that people are looking to for simple answers to complex questions. And it's really our role to be creative and to come up with those ways of explaining things to the public that are engaging, even if it isn't the sexiest of messages.
Definitely. So for those that are lucky enough to work alongside a nutritionist or a dietitian in their food and beverage industry, what can they do to help combat misinformation?
Well, I think really these guys are kind of doing this all the time, and we've got some amazing nutritionists and dietitians working in industry. So as I said, that work with marketeers and other people within organizations is absolutely vital. And not being a naysayer, I think that's also very, very important, like we've just said. So it's about finding solutions. It's about looking at, what we want to say. That, taking your point on board, Laura, and of course, there are sometimes things that you can say, but whether it's right or not. And actually, that reminds me of an example I had with a marketeer once who was absolutely adamant he wanted to make a particular claim about brain function at the time. The nutrient was there in the product and could support it. But I had to work really hard to explain to this guy that actually, in the UK, we have enough of this ingredient, this nutrient. We don't necessarily need any more. If we did have any more, it's not going to make any difference to brain function. So really taking that time to explain the science to this marketeer, there was a real sort of click moment for him, and he really understood at that point that actually this, okay, I understand. Although we can say this, we shouldn't say this, and this isn't going to be therefore, a fair or accurate message to put out there. So once we got to that stage, the next step is obviously to really think about, well, okay, so what can we say instead? What else do we have in the product, or what changes could we make to the product to put different nutrients in that perhaps we do need more of in the UK in order to make a more compelling claim? So there are small things like this that our nutrition professionals are doing all the time, and obviously all of that is so important, and that obviously goes alongside all of the reformulation work that is going on to support government strategies, often driven by those nutrition professionals upwards in companies. So working very closely with leadership teams, you know, being involved right at the highest levels to really help those guys understand why we should be making these changes. And I've actually always been lucky enough to be in organizations that understood that from the start. So you're pushing on an open door to a certain extent, but not all people in the industry are that lucky. So really helping bring that science into organizations and help them understand that actually, you know, good health can equal good business. And I think that is a really key point. And once you get everyone bought into that within your organization, you're all driving the same things forward.
Totally. It's speaking their language, which is the commercial aspects, profit, sales, but then translating that into, but actually health will generate those good things.
Exactly.
And it's for the better for people and planet. So I definitely think we're moving in that direction, but it is still, you know, a bit of an upwards pill battle. But we're getting there. And I think what we're saying there around, you know, working with our colleagues, there is a lot of internal marketing and comms that needs to take place. And that happens, you know, in the food and drink industry, a lot behind the scenes. I think the public think that we're probably doing a lot of stuff outwardly, when actually a lot of what we're doing is the inward stuff in terms of educating our colleagues on health and good nutrition practice. And within the food and drink industries, often these teams are quite lean. So there might only be sort of one or two of us working for a company. So you're often doing these things alone, which can feel a little bit isolating when you're working for a company and trying to, you know, really push the messaging and do what's right. And I suppose that's where these external groups come in to provide that support, because, you know, we do need to feel supported and connected as a nutrition community in order to move the dial within our companies. And it can be quite difficult.
Yeah, and I think that's so right. And obviously we would love to have teams of 5 or 10 nutritionists and dietitians working in companies, but that's just not realistic. So yeah, how can we support each other? And I think also, you know, how can nutritionists and dietitians support each other? And we need to always be considered as, you know, one team fighting the same battle, no matter where we're working.
Definitely.
We're all trying to make the world healthier. And actually we often start our workshops at universities there, asking people, the students, you know, why are you excited about a career in nutrition? And they pretty much always say, because they want to help people and they want to make everyone healthier. So we are all, you know, coming at this from that same angle.
Definitely. Very well said. So Lauren, over to you. Let's talk about the advertising laws, which it can be quite scary. I was looking at them prior to this episode and I was like, God, there's just something about them. They speak in another language. It's kind of this legal words and sentences that just makes it so hard to understand. But are you able to kind of advise which companies need to adhere to these advertising laws? And are there any advertising laws that we need to adhere to around the communication of nutrition information?
So I think Anna summed it up really well. I obviously went into kind of what there is and what there isn't. So to answer this question, the short answer is yes, but it's a lot longer than that. The laws, I will say, do mainly concern food labelling, such as required information on packaging. They do cover nutritional claims or health claims. So things like what you can say about a specific nutrient. So obviously Anna gave that amazing example of brain function, or things like what we can say are things like, you know, biotin contributes to the maintenance of hair growth. But they are really strict. If you look up the laws, they are tight. They are watertight in terms of what we can and what we can't claim. However, when it kind of comes to sharing nutritional misinformation, the lines do get a bit blurry. And that's because, so the Advertising Standard Agency states ads must not mislead and claims should be supported with evidence. However, what we are seeing is a lot more quote unquote evidence that suits the claim, regardless of the quality or the robustness of that evidence. So the laws quite clearly applies to companies or to big corporations. If you've got something like a food product and it's labeled as, you know, helps with brain function. But as we move down the line and see more podcasts and individual speaking on social media, it's really quite difficult to pinpoint what these individuals are bound by. Obviously, nutritional professionals, such as regulated dietitians and registered nutritionists, we have a code of conduct. Whereas if you're not a nutritional professional and you're not a big company and you're on a podcast, there is that element of, you know, dare I say, things like freedom of speech. And some people may have the best intentions, but they're unqualified to be delivering these messages. And by doing so, they are in fact breaking the regulations, whether they know about them or not. I think it's really interesting. I will say, from my understanding, I do think the laws are quite grey, which does allow people to get away with more when it comes to things like spreading nutritional misinformation. And so, yes, there are the regulations in place, but you do have to question their effectiveness when there's no enforcement protocols built into them. And in recent times, we've seen so much misinformation being spread on a mass scale with no obvious challenges or prevention from regulating bodies. So I do think to discuss more about the legal adherence, we would need to certainly consult a lawyer specialising in this area, because I completely agree, Corinne, when I was looking at them, they are just a minefield. However, dietetically speaking, there are definitely concerns that we can raise around the legislation that is in place about what people can and can't say. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely seeing, since our kind of transition out of the UK, out of the EU, from ourselves in the United Kingdom, our health laws were once upon a time very much very health focused, really health focused, but we are seeing a slight transition to a more business focused laws when it comes to health. So I think that's also something to note when we're talking about nutrition information, because it is, you know, ultimately nutrition is a business, whether we like it or not. It is a health science at its core, but it has, in more recent years, it is becoming more of a business. So I do think the, you know, the laws, it would be good for them to be updated, so there is that kind of more refined of what people can and can't say and who can say what as well.
Yeah, you made some great flags there, Lauren.
I mean, I think, yeah, it's a really interesting point there. We could almost have a whole episode talking about this one area,
yeah,
couldn't we?
Yeah.
I think it is interesting to note that the Advertising Standards Agency does cover a lot more than what people might think. So mm-hmm. you might think that just covers, you know, your adverts on telly, and, you know, what might go into a magazine, but actually it does cover social media and digital as well. And I think, you know, I might be jumping the gun a little bit, because one of the questions coming up is about what we as health professionals can do. But, you know, when we see something that's wrong, we can report that to the Advertising Standards Agency. So when we see an influencer doing something that they potentially shouldn't be, we can make that complaint. And, you know, let's do it as a profession. Let's have a call to action. You know, let's step up and make our voices heard. My beetroot latte example, I didn't actually challenge that cafe owner. Maybe I should have done. You know, there are things that we can do. And particularly when it comes to the ASA, they are bound to take every single complaint seriously. So I think there is definitely something there. That when it comes to regulations, it's also, there's a particular issue where us as health professionals can't make certain claims that other influencers can, and we won't get into all the nitty-gritty of the regulation because it's very complicated and also has some grey areas. But it does mean that some of those influencers can say things we can't, which in a way seems ridiculous, but in a way, of course, protects the public because we are trusted health professionals, but they are still bound by those same regulations if they're making health claims when paid for by a brand, for example. So if we see something that says ad next to it, or we think should say ad next to it, and is making an illegal health claim, then we can complain about that.
Brilliant. Thank you. Lauren, what are the potential dangers of following nutrition advice without verifying its accuracy? And can you give us some top line red flags that healthcare professionals can share with their patients to help them assess the credibility of nutrition information?
Definitely. I think that following any source of nutrition from an unverified source, it first of all causes a lot of confusion. And because there's so much talk in the media, one day it's this diet, one day it's this diet, I wouldn't be able to keep up. I would be changing what I was eating every 5 minutes. So it's very confusing, which isn't nice anyway. But if you're following advice that, you know, is not regulated or there's no evidence behind it, it could actually in fact cause a lot of diet-related health issues, such as nutritional deficiencies. And that's just at a really kind of simple level. And there's a reason that we say consult your healthcare professional, because actually, if you've got a medical condition and you're following a really quack diet, you know, I'm thinking of if you've got something like diabetes and you then follow a diet that is not suitable for your diabetes, it could put you into some really serious health problems. Not to mention the kind of serious harm it can cause to just the general public. My biggest potential danger, and it's something I'm really passionate about, is the nutrition advice out there at the moment. We're seeing such an increase in restrictive eating and disordered eating, because actually what's being shared is not what I would call healthy eating at all. It's actually quite disordered eating. It's not something that is accurate and we want shared. So I think it's really, really important that people are aware of the potential dangers. Some of my key red flags at the moment is if they're trying to sell you a product or they're trying to promote something, whether that be an app, whether that be the diet itself. There's a reason that regulated healthcare professionals like registered dietitians and registered nutritionists, we're not allowed to promote a product, just one. I think if we're giving an example, we have to give at least three, as far as I was previously aware. So there's a reason that that is in place for things like affiliation. And again, like Anna said, it should have ad next to it. And if it doesn't, always be a bit wary of that. But yeah, be really careful if they're trying to promote your product. Also, another red flag is look at who's promoting it. Are they a regulated professional, or is it just someone that has a lot of money and a lot of fame? Another red flag is they don't list their sources. So they'll continually say things like this study, this study, this study. And I hear it so much where it says a study, but there's nothing in the show notes. There's nothing, there's no references, or there's, if they have listed them, they're not credible sources. And my final one would be, it seems too good to be true. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. And it's probably just not that credible. So those would be kind of my really top red flags.
All very good red flags. And going back to that science piece, I think it's we're getting into a bit of difficult territory with the whole link to a science paper situation, because there's one thing having a scientific paper, there's another thing in terms of the quality of that study. And how can you actually communicate that to the general public when they've got 2 seconds, you've got 2 seconds of their attention? You know, if it says science backed, that is something that they trust. But actually, you know, as scientists and healthcare professionals, we can then go on the study and say, well, it only had two participants, so that's not an eligible study. And that is also really difficult. Any kind of insights on that, Anna or Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a problem that we've kind of always had in a way. And obviously, I think that's probably what sets us apart in a way in terms of our training, in that we can look at that one paper and we can position that as part of the rest of the evidence. So yeah. no matter how good that one paper is, it is still one paper and it doesn't prove anything necessarily. So, having that knowledge is obviously vital, and what we can do. I think in general, actually, you mentioned in your introduction, Lauren, about scientific literacy. You know, again, if we can go right back to basics, and if we could explain to people, if people could be taught in schools right from the start how to spot some of these things and how to understand, you know, what you should be looking out for, and building that scientific literacy, it would really help us and help people to understand that weight of evidence a bit better.
Yeah. So let's take a moment then to look at some current popular trends that are based on nutrition misinformation. Are there any which stand out to you? Let's go to you both on this one. But Lauren, if we start with you.
I think, yeah, there's so much on ultra processed foods. Bless them. They're getting a pretty bad rap for themselves at the moment. And not all ultra processed foods are created equally. There are some that are absolutely fantastic. And I've done a lot of work with the NOVA classification. And actually, we need a whole new classification, because not all of the ultra processed foods are as bad for us as, you know, they all get kind of tarnished with the same brush. And actually, a lot of things are perfectly fine to eat as long as a healthy, balanced diet. I'm really heavily stressing that word balance. Life is a balance. We're seeing a lot of demonizing again on sugar, which I feel has done a complete like Anna said, everything goes in trends. We're seeing it again. And it's really hard. I'm seeing a lot of patients kind of come into my clinic. And when you kind of unpick it, you're like, oh, why are you only eating this? And they're like, oh, because I heard this. And then it's really hard to kind of change their opinion once it's so ingrained in them. So I think my ones at the moment are ultra processed foods. Sugar gets, you know, is getting a really bad rap again. Carbs have always kind of had that
carbs,
yeah, they've always had that bad reputation. It kind of goes in waves as to people's thoughts on them. But then equally, a lot of nutrients are getting a lot of praise and going the other way. When I think, I mean, they're okay, like they're a great food, but I wouldn't go as far as calling them a superfood, or, you know, they're not going to, you know, if I eat, you know, a kilo of blueberries a day, it's not going to change my life. And if anything, is actually probably going to cause me some health like problems. So I think demonizing or putting one food on a pedestal, it's not as simple as that. We need a diet that's, you know, based on whole foods, but giving us that good variety is really important. A trend is just that, it's a trend. It's not a staple in our lives. It's just something that comes and goes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with everything you've said. I think some of those things obviously made it onto my list as well, and ultra-processed foods being the top at the moment, so everybody is talking about. And I think everybody in the scientific community understands that the NOVA classification isn't necessarily fit for purpose, and we can't group all of those foods in together. But that isn't getting through to the public, and that is spreading fear, you know, and that is not helpful if people think that they can't eat sliced wholemeal bread from the supermarket anymore, because that's an unhealthy food now. I mean, that is pretty shocking. Add that to the fear of carbs that we've never cracked. You know, we are in a bit of trouble there. But I think there's a few others as well. And you mentioned sugar, and I hear bananas are getting a bad reputation at the moment. What on earth is that about? You know, we need to get that message out to the public. Just eat your five a day. It doesn't matter which ones, just get them in, you know. And these messages we've been sharing for years, and, you know, it's not working yet. So that obviously doesn't help. And then the slight fear at the moment about seed oils, I also don't understand. We need to be encouraging people to consume healthy fats, to understand the difference between, you know, good and bad fats. And then the other one that springs to mind for me, which actually goes back to the red flags. And I think my key red flag is cutting out any kind of food group, is the kind of vegan and plant-based trend. Obviously some benefits there can be if done well, but I think my concern is people are just cutting out those food groups and not understanding how to build that healthy, balanced diet around a vegan diet, for example. And that fear around some animal foods. And I say this as a vegetarian, but a slightly frustrated vegetarian these days when a veggie pizza has vegan cheese on it instead of the cheese that I love. So, you know, it's actually limiting choices for in some situations. So again, we just need people to understand how to build that healthy, balanced diet, whatever, you know, way they choose, you know, whether they choose to be plant-based or not. And obviously we should be encouraging more plants, but not necessarily cutting out everything else at the same time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I keep seeing eggs come up again. Eggs have had a bad rep. They had a good rep and then it changes again.
Oh, I haven't heard that. Right, that's one to watch then.
Yeah, eggs and keto diets as well is one of those ones that kind of, you know, I think for some people, obviously it does work for weight loss, but I think, you know, is the science there for the long-term measures of it? We don't know. So again, that's another one that I think is a little bit...
And the unintended consequences that I think, obviously, perhaps people thinking about that are thinking about weight loss, but they're not potentially thinking about their cardiovascular health or other issues that are going to potentially come down the line. So again, it's that overall understanding that we need to build.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And you touched on this a little bit, Anna, in terms of, you know, making that call and reporting it and calling people out if we see any misinformation or you know, someone doing something that we don't agree with and isn't in line with our code of conduct. What responsibility do we have as nutrition professionals to tackle misinformation? Lauren, let's go to you on this one.
As a profession, I feel it's very much our responsibility, but That being said, it shouldn't be placed on just a key few individual nutritional professionals. And I think it starts with making sure we know what dietitians and what nutrition professionals do and what we're qualified to do, and really making the public aware of this, making sure that they're listening to the right people, the right qualified and regulated people, but also having us in those spaces. We need to be, in more mainstream areas. And I think that's what I would say what we're struggling with at the moment. We're great on LinkedIn. We are, as professionals, we're great. We've been shouting about, trust dietitians, trust registered nutritionists for ages. But are we in those really mainstream public spaces? I would argue no. So we do have that responsibility, but it's also, we do need that call to action. We should, as a collective, we've got, we are a strong in numbers profession. We should be having things like direct meetings with the ASA. We should be having direct meetings with those kind of key legislation holders to actually say, hang on a minute, we are seeing more and more of this. What are you doing? And it is our responsibility, but we need to do it as a group and as a collective, because together we are stronger.
Yeah, and just to jump in there, we actually had the ASA to speak at our meeting last week, and that was fantastic to get them in the room and get their real insights and to just understand the sheer amount of work that they do. They're doing a fantastic job trying to keep on top of a very difficult, very broad, communications landscape at the moment. And actually, one of the most impressive things that they said there, I thought, was that they're actually being very proactive now. So they're not just looking at complaints that come into them, but they're going out looking for bad information as well. So, that they're doing a great job. But I guess the question is, how can we as a group of professionals support that?
That's really good to know. What about organisations such as the British Dietetic Association or the Association of Nutrition? What are they doing to protect this space, Lauren?
I think it's difficult for any organisation to always be doing enough. Personally, I do think they could definitely be doing more. And BDA have some great campaigns, things like Trust a Dietitian. But it would be good to see more of these campaigns and more public presence from the likes of BDA and the AFN. I think personally, statements from these organisations when people are misusing the title or making false nutrition claims would be really beneficial to let us as a collective professions know that our organisations are aware and they are taking action. And like I said there, BDA runs some really good campaigns with things like their fad diet campaign that they've got and the Trust a Dietitian campaign. However, I think more visibility is needed. The visibility for these campaigns are great in the health sector, but we do need to get them out not just within the healthcare community, but with things like public campaigns. So things like an injection of funding from the government to raise awareness of qualified nutritional professionals would be great, and where you should be going to get that nutritional information, whether that be, BDA doing posters or getting on these prime time shows and really kind of meeting the public where they're at and getting into these mainstream spaces to get our voices heard, and really meeting the public where that they're at. So they do have some good campaigns, but a lot more needs to be done to tackle it from a body point of view.
Oh,
And just
amazing.
yeah, just to add to that as well, I mean, I was really pleased to see the creation of the Academy of Nutrition Sciences. So for people that haven't heard about that, I mean, that's the AFN, the BDA, the BNF, British Nutrition Foundation, and the Nutrition Society all teaming up together. So I think it's a bit TBC what they will do in the future. They have got some joint position statements, but whether they can do more to drive this extra credibility of nutrition professionals into that space, because I think you're absolutely right. We're good at talking to each other, but we also need to go out more widely there. And then I think, there's a role for us at Nutrition Talent. There's obviously some other great organizations that are doing some really good role to rate really good a job at raising the profile of nutrition professionals. But yeah, we could certainly all jointly, I think it's a really important part, joined together to do more there.
Absolutely. And I think it's, we need to meet the public where they are. So look at how we're delivering our advice, and what platforms we should be on, and kind of really advertise ourselves. And it's all really good having these chats on these platforms, like we're saying, but we really need to be like identifying our key audiences where they are and on the platforms that they use.
I agree completely.
Yeah, and on that note, the BDA, I believe, are launching a TikTok soon. I don't know if you've seen that.
They are,
yes. Yes, and they have asked for dietitians and nutritionists to be involved as kind of front-facing media spokespeople for them. So I really do think there's a huge opportunity there for us to, as you say, meet the public where they are. I think that statement is so key, what you said there, Lauren, because we obviously talk amongst ourselves, but actually accessing the public, that's a whole different thing. Mm. So yeah, TikTok, TV, you know, the more we can get on TV and fly the flag of evidence-based nutrition, the better. So yeah, watch this space. And Anna, what are some reliable sources people can turn to for accurate information on social media and in the podcast space? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've talked about some of the organisations and some of the great work that they're doing. I think it's often more digital than social potentially. So if we're thinking about the BDA fact sheets, which are, I always send people towards, Heart UK, British Heart Foundation, Diabetes UK, NHS, they all do a great job on websites. I think on social, I have seen nutrition professionals being brave and stepping up recently. And I think this is possibly to combat that rise in misinformation that we spoke about right at the start. There's a few people doing that particularly well. I think I love Claire Baisley's posts on Instagram. She is really engaging with everyone in a very humorous way, which is great because that really engages people. I think we should give a shout out to Charlotte Sterling Reed, who has done a fantastic job of really becoming the go-to nutritionist for children's nutrition. And she has teamed up with Joe Wicks, so a very, very big influencer. And to give him his absolute due, he realized that he wasn't the expert in a particular area, teamed up with Charlotte, and they've done work together and released a book together on weaning. So I think that's just brilliant that an influencer realized that he needed support in a scientific area and went to a registered nutritionist in order to help him deliver that. So hopefully that might sow the seed for a couple of other influencers as well. And then when it comes to podcasts, I guess a little plug for the Humans of Nutrition podcast. But that's, you know, that's mainly for professionals really. But then I was also listening to Rhiannon Lambert's podcast recently, which I think is a really good source of information and a very good listen. Obviously has a massive listenership, if that's the correct term. So some really good podcasts out there. But Lauren, I'm sure you've got some other podcast recommendations as well.
Yeah, I think you've made a really good point because a lot of them are for healthcare professionals. However, I would go a step further and think, well, do you know what? We're producing this really good content, things like the Dietitian Cafe. Mm. We could get the public involved and things like that, I think, would be really good because you've got the professionals there. So I think that's a really, really good one. Definitely anything that has a credible healthcare professional on. I think sometimes it's easy to see the word doctor and think, oh yes, I can trust them. But really kind of having our wits about us and think, is this person a credible source and are they, you know, giving nutritional misinformation? So that's why going to podcasts like the Dietitian Cafe are really good, because we know that there's regulated dietitians on there, there's registered nutritionists, so we know that we're kind of speaking the truth and not you know, saying anything untoward. And also some people I think are being really, really brave on TikTok and Instagram. I know it takes a lot as a registered dietitian. I almost feel a bit like scared to go on those platforms because I do have a code of conduct to adhere to. I'm almost a bit nervous about like breaking that, even though I shouldn't be, because you know we are the qualified people that should be in those spaces. So I think that's really important to note as well.
That's such a good point. I think many people who are speaking out about this misinformation probably feel a bit scared, a bit nervous about how they're going to be judged or perceived by regulators, other professionals, consumers. And I mean, what would be your top tips for being brave and speaking out publicly?
I started really small. I just started doing little LinkedIn posts, just giving my thoughts. When I would pick like one thing, you know, I picked like one podcast that I was really, really cross with because they were just spreading so much poor nutritional misinformation. And I just kind of broke it down. I broke the facts. Be evidence-based. Don't forget your skill set as well, because we communicate and translate nutrition science every single day. We are used to doing it to our patients or in different platforms, but don't be scared, because I'm sure we all use social media in our personal lives, and it's just kind of having that blend of doing it professionally. Also looking up your code of conduct, making sure you are sticking to it, seeking advice from other professionals that have done it. Reaching out to those key content creators themselves. And yeah, I think there is an element of being brave, and don't be scared to call out particular, you know, influencers or even our regulating bodies. I know that I've said things that I would like the BDA to do more, and I'm not scared to say that anymore because I'm a member. I would hope to think that I'm a valued member. So I think there is that thing of being brave and knowing, you know what, we studied. I've, you know, like to think that I'm perfecting my craft of being a dietitian. So it's all part of the job role that we are undertaking to, you know, share the messages, share evidence. And like Anna said, we're all in this to, you know, make people healthier. So yeah, it might change the way that, you know, it might change how that looks, but ultimately it's the skills, same skill set.
What do you think, Anna, on that point?
I absolutely agree with everything you said there, really. I think it is important that we step up and learn to be brave. But on that point, we do need to support each other. And maybe that is something that the BDA and the AFN can help us with. You know, what are the top tips that we should be thinking about when we are engaging more in this space, which can definitely feel a bit scary. And I know there are social media guidelines and things like that we can refer back to. But I also think we need to use each other as sounding boards. You know, it takes a lot to do one social media post. I think, mm-hmm. you know, we have got to accept that, you know, we've got busy lives, we've got busy jobs, we've got patients to see in your case, and, you know, we've got clients to look after in my case. But, you know, what can we do within that code of conduct, like you said, but also thinking, how can we be as engaging as possible? So as well as, you know, what's possible, it's also, you know, can we all have some collective media training? Yeah. I've had media training in the past, and it was hugely, hugely, you know, invaluable, really. And it does help you, you know, when you're talking to one person who's got that very set mindset, and, you know, you can't just say, no, that's wrong, and you're wrong because X, Y, Z, because that doesn't work. That doesn't get the information across. You need to listen to that person, understand their concerns, then think about how, you know, the right way is, you know, to get a few key facts in, but in that engaging manner. So perhaps we need mass media training.
Absolutely.
That's an idea.
Absolutely. And I think the BDA have done some media training, but it would be great to see more. It'd be great to see it at an education level at universities. Mm. And also, I think, not sure how relevant this is, but I think getting, you know, dietitians and registered nutritionists in these spaces, but also, I don't know how we achieve this, but making sure we're valued. I think we are one of the only healthcare professions that are expected to do all of this work for free. And I know we're talking about hidden agendas and money, so I'm not talking too much about that, but more so kind of making sure that we have the appropriate people, but we're also paying them for their time. Because mm-hmm. I'm sure Anna will agree, we've got these qualifications, and we do want to work with these organisations, but it's also making sure we are valued, and, you know, our time is precious, just like any other profession is. So making sure that we're in those spaces, but equally we're being paid and treated fairly as you would any other profession. And I think that's why I do like the Trusted Dietitian campaign, because, you know, you wouldn't expect a plumber to come around and sort something out for free. So you shouldn't, the likewise shouldn't be expected of us to just come and sort it, even though it's our responsibility, come and sort it out for free.
Yeah. This has all been really interesting conversation. Let's move over to talk about the governmental regulations and dietary guidelines and the role that they play to help prevent the spread of misinformation. Anna, are there any improvements that could be made in this area?
I think that's another topic that could really be a whole other podcast for us to chat about. There's such a lot there. And I know we've actually talked a little bit about those regulations and potentially some of those improvements already. I do think we need to remember that there are quite a lot of regulations already in place. Some of them could certainly be improved. I'm thinking about the on hold botanicals list that has been there for so many years. And basically there is a very big long list of claims that in theory you can make, in practice you can't really. Those claims need to be approved or rejected so everybody knows where we are. So I think there could certainly be progress in that space. And then if we think about dietary guidelines, it's a terrifying fact, but we know that less than 1% of people are achieving all of the Eat Well guide recommendations. So I think people know that they should eat five a day, but they don't necessarily know what makes up a portion. You know, there are still a lot of work to do with what we've already got before we, you know, throw baby out with the bathwater. It would be nice to actually be able to get those messages across in that engaging way that we've been talking about. So I don't think those messages are necessarily wrong, but we do have to position them better. And the phrase that you used earlier, Lauren, about meeting people where they are is something that we talk about a lot with our clients, actually, when we're thinking about campaigns with them. And it's so vitally important. And I think a great example of some work that's come out recently is the Scottish version of the Eat Well Guide. There's also an African and Caribbean version of the Eat Well Guide. So these are brilliant resources because they are meeting people where they are. They are putting those foods into the context of what they eat on a daily basis. And we've got to always remember that, along with some of those other factors around society that I mentioned before about managing on a tight budget, potentially not having the cooking skills or even the cooking facilities. You know, we forget that some people, you know, don't even have a fridge. You know, they are living in really difficult circumstances. And really always remembering that relevance to real life. So if we could find a way to get those messages out there to people in that way that is going to be engaging, obviously that's a good place to start before rewriting everything, even though I know there are potentially some improvements that could be made as well.
Right. Thank you, Anna. Lauren, in what ways do you think the collaboration between qualified nutrition professionals and media outlets, so the owners of Spotify, Instagram, how could they be improved to ensure the promotion of scientifically accurate information?
I think it could be done almost quite simply. I think first and foremost, we need a collaborative approach, something like an MDT approach that we have in healthcare. For health topics discussed on media outlets. So for example, having a dietitian, having a research personnel, having a legal team, general consumers, to really give this rounded holistic approach. So, you know, for example, Spotify, making sure the right people are talking on these topics and making sure that everything that is being said is evidence-based, and going a step further, that the evidence is also discussed. Because as a dietitian, and I'm sure, you know, both of you would agree, I feel very qualified to look at a piece of evidence and say, oh, do you know what? No, that's a bit naff. Or, oh, this is a really good study. It's got some really good, you know, research behind it. But also giving that to the public and being very objective when it comes to nutritional information, because we are going to all have our own biases. That is just the facts of life, but we can work with these media outlets to show them the law, educate them, and in doing so kind of promote scientific accurate information.
Right. I think that's a really clear call to action for hopefully some of these media outlets who may or may not be listening, but let's try and get this podcast in, you know, streaming through their headphones so they actually listen to this conversation. That's a start. So now we're going to close off the session, and by looking ahead, what do you think are the best ways to combat nutrition misinformation from being disseminated? Let's go to you first, Anna.
Right. Well, that's a big question. And I think we've come up with a few ideas throughout the episode so far. So I think we do need to keep speaking out when we see something that doesn't look right. And I think we all need to be a bit braver in doing that. So we can get in touch with the ASA. We can write into those magazines or newspapers. Yeah, let's get the boss of Spotify to have a conversation with us. You know, I love that idea. I can have that conversation with that cafe owner. You know, there's little things that we can do. I think what we all need to remember is that we have to do this in a constructive way. So I think going back to my example with the marketeer and the brain function, let's not just tell people what they can't do, but let's use our creative skills as well as our scientific skills to come up with those solutions. You know, we should always be solution focused. And I think that's a real strength in our profession that we can do that. And of course, ensure those qualified nutrition professionals are in the right places. So, you know, let's make sure that we're part of that conversation and we're employed across all sectors. And I think my final thing really is just let's all stick together. You know, I think this is so important. It's going to be an ongoing battle probably for the rest of our careers, sadly. But we can make strides, particularly if we work together.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. How about you, Lauren?
I couldn't agree more with everything that Anna said. She summed it up so perfectly. Absolutely, we need to do it together. It's not just on one person. We need to get ourselves in, you know, more mainstream areas, continue having conversations like these, come up with solutions and gentle solutions. We don't have to go in all guns blazing. We can be really gentle in our approach and get our voices heard without having to shout into the void, because I appreciate it's quite exhausting, because like you said, Anna, we are probably going to be have to dealing with this for the rest of our careers. So let's come up with constructive ways that don't exhaust us and take the joy out of this profession.
Yeah, really well said. I hope we can get to a place one day where we're not fighting fads and misinformation all the time and just kind of supporting evidence-based information and reiterating positive points. But yeah, you two have closed off the session in a perfect way. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. It's been so great speaking with you both.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, and a huge thank you to NewOutra for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed listening to today's episode, why not share it with a friend or colleague who you think would find it interesting? Our next episode of the Dietitian Cafe will be out soon, and in the meantime, you can check out our previous episodes or head over to our RD2B Dietitian Cafe podcast, where once a month our student dietitian host discusses the world of dietetics with a range of guests, all aimed at aspiring dietitians. Thank you for joining us at the Dietitian Cafe. See you next time.